conference, I'd like you to welcome you to this very important session on education. Since becoming, having the privilege of becoming chair of the Education Committee 6 months ago, if you didn't know it already, one of the things that strikes you very clearly and very quickly about education is the wide diversity of issues. Indeed, we could actually spend an entire day, or indeed many days, actually dealing with a number of those issues. I suspect, however, if we were to carry on beyond 12 o'clock, that wouldn't make either me or any other members of the panel very popular with the rest of you. But to reflect that level of diversity, we have a panel covering, which will cover a wide range of issues and a wide range of topics. Let me introduce the panel just from my left to right. On my left, we have Andrea Sawyer, who is the principal of Ocker Central Primary School. Sitting beside me, a lady who needs no introduction, our junior minister, Emma Pengelly. To my immediate right is Nicola Werner, just getting the name correct in relation to that. One of the, I should maybe say to the chairman, just in relation to, if he's listening, that's obviously one of the roles here is chair of education. We get to mark people's homework in that regard. So we're very pleasurable to welcome Nicola Werner here, who deals with inclusive services, particularly involving children and young people in the community. And Liz Fawcett, familiar face as well, who particularly is interested and has been involved with parents in terms of school flexibility of starting age. So I'll maybe turn first of all to Emma. Emma, while we've got a lot of success within education in Northern Ireland, and sometimes we tend to decry that success, there has been a long-standing problem with education under-attainment. And particularly, I think a lot of the studies have shown that problem of being under-attainment, particularly among male working-class Protestants. This has been obviously one of the issues that you've seen as a key priority since you've come to Stormont, and you've helped set up, establish and become chair of the all-party group on education underachievement. Could you perhaps tell conference a little bit about that and what you hope to achieve from the all-party group?
Thank you. Well, I think, first of all, I would say that for the vast majority of people and our young people in Northern Ireland, education does work. And Northern Ireland has a very, very good record in relation to education, and our young people are some of the most skilled right across the world. But for a significant percentage, a minority of young people, year on year, there is a significant level of educational underachievement or educational failure or low attainment. And the education system have struggled to try to find solutions to that. We are not alone in that. Right across the UK, this is a big problem. If you look across the UK, young British white males are the worst performing group. So this isn't something that's just around Northern Ireland, but it is a big problem for us. There's been a number of reports. Very recently, we've had an Equality Commission report which has highlighted the problem, not just initially in terms of educational failure for our young Protestant working class boys, but the fact that in 10 years' time or 20 years' time or 30 years' time, there's going to be a very significant problem in relation to them being able to access leadership positions, being in the management of the public sector, the management in our businesses and business leaders. So this is a big problem, not just for now, but a problem in 10, 20, 30 years down the line. So I was very keen to look at what action can be taken to try to address these issues. Through the Office of First Minister, we had done a significant amount of work in relation to the Delivering Social Change agenda. And that agenda was very much about taking these big problems where we need solutions and trying to bring new thinking to that. So we introduced the Numeracy and Literacy Scheme. That came in on top of the Education Department, and within 1 year we saw improvements of just above 6% in relation to those young people going through that programme. So that really demonstrated to me the benefit of coming up with new schemes outside the Department of Education, getting those funded centrally and driving those forward through the executive. And I think the DUP are in a unique position to be able to do that. So that's why I created the all-party group.
And in terms of that, I mean, one of the key drivers within this, as you've indicated, is you talk to any expert, they'll tell you early intervention is critical to this, and also providing a joined-up approach. And that's why I think particularly the feedback that I've got from schools and indeed from various groups across the country is that sort of early intervention, and particular the project that was put in terms of the numeracy and literacy was actually something that made a very significant difference. Unfortunately, because of the pressures on the budgetary side, that had to be, I suppose, drawn back. But in terms of, do you see sort of a strong linkage between your role at OFM, DFM, and the education underachievement side of things to provide that sort of joined up solutions to some of our problems on that front?
One of the issues that really struck us sitting in the centre was that educational failure is not just an education issue. It has that impact right across in terms of poverty, in terms of employment, and in terms of the economy of Northern Ireland and how we grow the economy of Northern Ireland. We need our young people to be succeeding in greater numbers. So this isn't just an education issue. I think very much it's about sitting and looking at how that impacts on a range of other issues and how we can address that at an early stage, right from a child is very, very young. Through primary school, one of the key things we looked at was the fact that if a young person doesn't have those core tools, if they don't know how to count, they don't know how to read, then they're massively disadvantaged in relation to going into post-primary and being able to learn what they need to learn at that stage. But in addition, the Numeracy and Literacy Scheme also focused on our young people just before they took their GCSEs, and it was for this reason that I saw very many people who were in a position to fund extra tuition for their child. And if their young person got a D or an E in their mocks or in their fourth year exams, very many parents, they went out and they got that extra tuition for their child. And they did that with the great belief that that absolutely helps that young person get at least a C in their GCSEs. There are many, many thousands of parents across Northern Ireland that can't afford to do that, and that's why the Numeracy and Literacy Scheme was put in place, in order to provide that help and support for those young people that sit just below the line of a C in English and C in Maths, where a little bit of extra work and a little bit of extra attention can actually get that young person those key grades that are essential in terms of taking the next step. So, you know, that's why I was really, really pleased to see the good results. We're waiting for the second year results of that, and I'm hoping that the Education Minister, whoever the new Education Minister will be coming in, will take that scheme forward and mainstream it within the Department of Education.
Okay. Turning to Nicola. Nicola, I suppose one of the issues sometimes where people have a degree of misconception on education, while there's a high level of importance about what happens in the classroom, people seem to see, if you like, education interventions as purely classroom-based. Whereas particularly if we're looking at the issue of educational underachievement, a lot of the interventions actually need to happen both sort of before the child reaches school, but particularly the role of parents and the wider community are also vital to that process. I think from your experience, I mean, perhaps you'd highlight some of the significance of that intervention at the community and family level.
I think that it has become very recognised that education cannot sit in isolation, and that if we are truly supported to our children and young people and ensuring that they fulfil their potential, then we must really look beyond the school gates. There are three major influences in a young person's life. You've already talked about the school and the environment in which they learn, but also the community that surrounds them can be highly influential. And then, of course, at the very centre and at the heart of it all is the family and what happens within the family unit. For me, each one of those elements should be in balance. They should be contributing to the young person's life equally and positively. And they cannot do it alone. Within my work in integrated services, we see some families who struggle due to poverty, due to their own generational experiences of school and school life, and other factors that prohibit their parenting and their ability to support their child through their educational journey. There are many detrimental elements outside of school, and it is our job to try and support families to be the best they can to support their children. I know that in the audience today there are a lot of people who professionally work on the front line, whether they be teachers, whether they be social services, and they see the cost of late intervention. We talk a lot about early intervention, but actually there is a real cost to intervening late, and that's not just in financial terms, it's also the human cost. This section is about education, but education in a child's life doesn't exist in isolation. And equally for me, as a parent, as well as a person working in the community, five GCSEs, grade A to C, should not define a young person, should not define a child in how they can achieve and move on in their future. So really the work within integrated services within Greater Shankill, I would say we have been extremely fortunate because that work is improving the life chances of children and young people. It has been a programme that has been transformational within the community, and it has been a critical element to supporting the needs of children and families in a very much holistic way. The experience that we have had in integrated services has also shaped the thinking and development of the first ever children and young people zone in Northern Ireland. That work is trailblazing, and it is so important for us to look at how we support the development of well-rounded children and young people and to help them plan a pathway that maybe 20, 30 years ago existed for a lot of us. We were certain of where our future was going. We were certain of what our future held. Now that's not so clear for a lot of children. So this Children and Young People Zone is very much at the forefront of being groundbreaking as an initiative, and we will see how that develops. Well,
from that point of view, the Greater Shankill has been, as you say, trailblazing. We've also seen good work being done, for instance, such as research in Lisburn. I mean, do you think, first of all, that those are useful models for other parts of Northern Ireland? And I suppose, secondly, you've mentioned, particularly in terms of the work with parents, one of the things certainly I've come across is at times there's a little bit of a vicious circle at times within families, that where you've had parents who themselves have maybe had a negative experience of education, it's not that they don't want good education for their kids. They sometimes get a little bit nervous of education. They're nervous even perhaps to go into the school or to engage with that. And that can then become a little bit of a vicious circle sometimes within the family. Just maybe ask you to comment on that. And as I said, what lessons really there are to learn for the rest of Northern Ireland from your experience in the Greater Shankill?
The problems have been built up over many, many years. They're generational and they're deep-seated and they will not be overcome by quick fixes. And I think that because of that, it requires commitment from all. It requires a long-term outlook and strategy on this. And it requires us all to work together to achieve real lasting change. But there are very good models out there that we can learn from and that we can adapt and embed within our own communities.
Okay. Turning to, if you like, a related but slightly different subject, Andrea, one of the things the Education Committee has been quite keen to examine has been around the area of area planning. We're quite often bombarded with figures about the number of empty school places. And I suppose this has led to a focus on area planning, a lot of which has not been particularly well implemented. And I suppose the impact, which again, for many people don't tend to realise, is the significance, if you like, of the school's estate to communities, particularly in rural areas. Coming from Ocker, what's been your experience of area planning and how would you see things moving forward, particularly for rural communities when it comes to schooling?
Yeah, well, I teach and I'm principal in Ocker Central Primary School, and I have the privilege of coming from a great school that has really turned itself around in the last 4 or 5 years. I work with a fantastic team of individuals that really care about children. And, you know, every day we have a massive responsibility to influence, empower and provide those children to have the skills to be the leaders of this country in the future. And in Ocker Central, our school is really at the heart of the local community. Our school brings in grandparents, it brings in parents, it brings in people from all different social and economic backgrounds. And it is fundamental to the survival of the rural school. Now, the Clogher Valley has had a hard ride with school closures. My three colleagues in the maintained sector beside me are all facing falling enrolment numbers, and there has been closure letters issued. That straight away has caused for reduced morale. We're starting on the journey for shared education, and yet they're wondering what's the point if they're not going to be here in the future. So although area-based planning does have its basis, it is needed. We need to look at how we can best utilise our resources. I do think it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not the magic 105 number. As a school, we have around 90 pupils. We have doubled our enrolment in 4 years. We have doubled our staffing, and we have two big extensions. Now, that's with a lot of hard work, a lot of determination, to make sure the children in the Clocker Valley have the best education of anywhere in Northern Ireland, and that takes work, but it also takes to ensure the right professionals are working in the schools, because with the right governors, the right staff and the right parents, if the team's right, it's amazing what you can achieve in Northern Ireland today.
And I mean, the impact of a school in terms of being at the heart of a community, that if you simply close a school, you rip the heart out of that. Sometimes that's not always been realised at times by the department, and indeed previously by the Education and Library Board. There is, though, an opportunity with the EA, as we're starting to review area planning, of a degree of fresh start. But I'd be interested as well, Andrea, you've mentioned one of the things that is quite often faced by a lot of schools we see, and we see, shall we say, very much a mixed picture out there, that some schools, whenever they get into a degree of decline, it's very, very difficult to turn that around. You've, in a situation where you've been able to rejuvenate the school, what do you think the lessons for elsewhere? What, shall we say, makes the success of turning a school around?
Well, I think it's all to do with teamwork. And I suppose schools are run by governors, and we need teams of governors that are visionary and that are willing to stand up and fight. You also need the right leadership in place, because without the right leadership and the right visionary force behind it, it's never going to achieve. And then you do need the support of parents, and you need pupils to be happy, to feel that the school is good for them. And you know, it's amazing what the other panellists have been saying so far this morning. As a teacher and a principal, I only have my children from 9 to 3. Somebody else has them from 3 to 9. When you consider the ramifications of that, school has got to be so much about partnership. And you know, if we really want to tackle educational underachievement in Northern Ireland, it needs to start on the maternity ward. Because, you know, by the time they come to P1, it's too late. I had a wonderful numeracy information evening last Monday night where I brought in an outside numeracy facilitator. He delivered a wonderful project to my families and my parents. I had some very well-educated parents who were scared stiff of teaching their child number bonds in P1. But you know, it's amazing what you can do with 2 dice. You can add, you can subtract, you can multiply, you can square root, you can do amazing things. It's amazing what a child can do when they realise, if I know 10p, I can get into the local shop to buy myself something. But you know, the key parents that I needed, they weren't there. The parents that I really needed to influence their child, I couldn't get. And even though I run it in the morning or the afternoon or the evening, I still can't get those people that I really need in to support their child. So somehow, in government and in Northern Ireland, we need to get it started right from the minute that baby's been born. We need to get the parents to feel equipped. We need to get them to stop worrying. You know, we are there to help. We're there to support. We will do anything we can to give the children in our care the skills that they need. But we do need to work in partnership, community and family. But it has got to start right away. So often in P1, it's too late. I'm the mother of 2 young children. I know the importance of the minute of the early years. Those first 3 years are the sponge that's key to the life ahead for my 2 children and for all the children in Northern Ireland.
Well, turning, I suppose, to the issue of early years and ensuring, and the mention's been made about, it's not always a question of a rigid sort of one-size-fits-all. The department, obviously, in recent days, it's published, obviously, legislation on shared education. We'll be soon seeing they bringing forward the anti-bullying legislation. But one area the department was to bring forward legislation on was flexibility on school starting age as regards legislation. Now, it seems to me, Liz, that not only have they backed off the idea of bringing forward the legislation, they seem to be dragging their feet at best on any level of flexibility. Do you think that's a fundamental mistake the department's making?
Absolutely, Peter, yes, and thank you very much for inviting me here today. Just to say briefly that I represent a grouping called School Start Flexibility NI, and it's got teaching unions, parents, and charities involved. And what we would like to see, what we've been campaigning for some years now, is just a very small amount of flexibility and a very small amount of parental choice at the early age of 4. Now, many of you may not be aware that Northern Ireland actually can boast the distinction of being the only country in the whole world where children are required to start at the age of 4. In Great Britain, children are not legally required to start school until they turn 5, and in most of the world, in fact, it's 6 or 7. We're not saying that the school starting age should be raised. Some of our members might like to see that, but we realise that that really would be a stretch too far. What we thought was, surely to goodness, we can have just a little bit of flexibility when a child isn't ready. The campaign actually started because my own child, who is seated at the back there, I felt was not anything near ready to start school at the age of four, still taking naps, still very much in a play-based mode, needing a lot of time outdoors. So I was able to keep him back, and it is possible to do. But it's only possible to do if you're incredibly determined, you go through hoops, you pay for a second year of preschool for your child yourself, and then find a school that is willing to take the child in P1 instead of P2. Now, a growing number of parents are doing that across Northern Ireland. Finally, after a campaign that started some 7 or 8 years ago, we've got to the position where the Department of Education has actually issued guidance, which, if you read between the lines and read very closely and really know what you're talking about, you will realise actually permits parents to do this. But they still have to pay for that second year for the preschool. There are no guarantees about getting their child into P1. Now, the Education Minister, to give him his fair due, agreed back in April 2013 with us that what we were asking for was perfectly reasonable. It happens in Scotland. This sort of flexibility can be seen down the Republic of Ireland. It can also be seen in England, where things have moved forward massively. Even though it's five legally, there are issues around flexibility there I won't bore you with. But essentially, very similar things were being called for in England. And first the coalition government, and now the Conservative government is moving on that. Because what the current Conservative government says, what the current schools minister says is, yes, of course, there should be a little bit of flexibility. Parents know their children best, and if they feel they need another year of preschool, then so be it. There's much research that I could bore you with, and I won't now, about how young for year children in both England and Northern Ireland perform significantly worse than children who are just a bit older. There's also research around outcomes in terms of special needs as well. There's every reason, basically, why that flexibility should be there. And what is very, very sad is that on this particular issue, the executive has failed for us to deliver so far.
Sometimes, Liz, with the department, they can, when faced with change, can certainly put the stockade up, try to resist it as much as possible. And I suppose one of the arguments that they will try and use is any sort of financial implications of greater flexibility. But perhaps you can explain to us, I mean, do you feel that's a degree of red herring if we're looking at the financial implications of any flexibility in terms of change?
Well, absolutely, because in fact, some money would be saved. I mentioned that there's an issue around children with special needs and additional support that's required. Just this week, for example, I was speaking to a parent who is actually having to provide private tutoring at primary school for her child because that child was young for year and just struggled to cope in P1 and rebelled, and there have been big issues since. There's another parent that I was speaking to this week where the primary school, she knew her child wasn't ready, the child's gone into P1, and they've had to put in extra support for that child. And we've heard many stories like that, including stories from teachers and school principals. The statistics actually show that children who are youngest for year in Northern Ireland are 13% more likely than their peers to end up being referred to educational psychology. So there's absolutely no doubt at all that there'd be money to be saved there. There's also other ways, and I know you've seen the figures, Peter, in which money could be saved. What I would say, Peter, if it's you or if indeed one of your colleagues in the DUP takes the education portfolio next time round, we need an education minister who is prepared to stand up to officials who understandably perhaps prefer the status quo. It's the old yes minister syndrome that we've seen with so many things, and I think Peter, perhaps you would agree that one does see it in particular in the Department of Education.
Liz, I'd agree. I think that there is a particular acuteness in terms of both a degree of silo mentality and indeed maybe a culture within the department which goes beyond simply who is in office in that regard. Obviously we're trying to cover quite a few subjects. I suppose maybe this leads us into the area of legislation is due to be produced on bullying and indeed combating bullying. obviously we're yet directly to see that published, but Andrea, maybe ask you, and as somebody who would be very much on the coalface, or the I was going to say the chalkboard, but it's probably more the interactive whiteboard nowadays, beginning to show my age at this point. In relation to that, what sort of initiatives or actions, either through the legislation or elsewhere, would you like to see being taken to try and combat the issue of bullying within schools?
Yes, well, I'll maybe start slightly controversially. Bullying is a word that is used far too commonly in our schools today. If a child is pushed or touched, it's bullying. If they're lining up for break and somebody pushes in, he bullied me. So I do think an overriding education on what bullying is. Now, once we start to build several pictures together, of course, bullying is real. And it is very evident in schools all over Northern Ireland, and it has to be tackled. But it's important that the word is used in the right context. So it is. And that is something now that a lot of my colleagues are very fearful about. Bullying takes all sorts of shapes and sizes, whether it's cyberbullying, whether it's bullying in the playground. I suppose the one thing that seems to override a lot of our principals' conferences is bullying rarely takes place within the confines of the classroom. When there's routine and there's structure and there's clear boundaries, generally the children are in a very safe environment. It's once those boundaries are put down, there is more scope for those things to take part or to happen. So yes, schools need help. So they do. But sometimes, especially in the post-primary sector, bullying is much more rife outside the school environment, but the school are the ones constantly being demanded to deal with it. The burden is being put onto schools. The burden has been put onto schools to provide information for parents, to provide training, which again brings back to the point the school is so central to the local community. So it is. So we do need help. We need guidance. Staff need trained. They need professional development in relation to how to deal with it, how to implement and reinforce positive reinforcement, how to praise encouraging behaviour, but then how to tackle those tricky issues which we do face. And cyberbullying probably in today is becoming the big massive issue, and that's certainly something where we need a lot of help and support from.
Liz, I've maybe turned to yourself. I mean, you mentioned in terms of that one of the problems in terms of lack of flexibility is that there will be some children for a range of reasons who are not really, it's maybe not appropriate necessarily for them to be starting school at the age of four, that you want a degree of flexibility. Is one of the byproducts of that problem a greater risk of bullying for those children?
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, we have heard of instances of bullying, so it can be. But I mean, if I can just sort of come back as a parent on the more general point, because it's very interesting to hear what Andrea said about how, you know, sometimes schools can feel that all the responsibility for bullying is being hoisted on their shoulders. And thankfully, it's not a problem that I, as a parent, have actually had to deal with. But I have seen other parents who've had this problem and who do look to schools. And I think, you know, the problem is it can get concentrated at school if it's happening at schools. I can see from a parent's perspective that it's very difficult if they feel that the school is failing to take action. I think it's very important indeed that all schools make it very clear to parents what can be done, make it very clear what the policy is, and actually ensure that that policy is enacted in practice. Basically, children are required to go to school. And therefore, I would say, and I'm sure Andrea could understand, that schools do have a responsibility to make sure that children feel safe and that children do actually have confidence when they're at school that they're not going to be subject to bullying.
Okay. Turning, I think, to another issue which has been picked up. I mean, again, part of the aim is always, that this party has always looked at, to try to get as much joined up government as possible. And one of the great values of education, indeed the great merits, is the opportunity to transform. It's probably the key changer, game changer for people's lives in terms of transforming lives. And obviously one of the key roles of education is preparing children up for life beyond school. And so in terms of that sort of joined up approach, where do we take it in terms of moving that forward in terms of particularly vocational education and looking, if you like, towards the world of work? Ask Emma first of all.
Peter, as you know, the DUP firmly believes that every child can succeed with the right support. And, you know, I do think, though, there needs to be a conversation about what success means in that context. And I think other people on the panel have highlighted the fact that we do focus on GCSE results. That is the way academic success is currently measured, and one of the reasons why I have done so much work in relation to the GCSE English and Maths is because that is a significant barrier to getting employment. If a young person doesn't have a C in English and a C in Maths, it's virtually impossible to get employment. However, I do think there needs to be a conversation about what success looks like. And I think all of us would agree that success is a good job with a reasonable wage. And ultimately, regardless of whether that's an academic path or that's a vocational path, that's what we want for our young people. I think there is a balance within this, though. I think we don't want schools to be too quick to write off our young people as non-academic and push them down a particular route. But at the same time, those young people with huge potential in relation to a range of skills shouldn't be pushed down an academic path. So I do think that there needs to be a conversation about this. I am hopeful that the all-party group will look at bringing forward a specific action on this, perhaps to pilot out looking at a combination approach at an earlier age, maybe at 14, to say some academic work, but also looking at vocational work, linking up with the DUP minister in Derry and other departments to say, where are the jobs going to be? How do we give our young people those skills to ensure that when they come out of the education system, they have a job, and that's a job that's likely to be about for a while, and it's a job that's going to pay them a reasonable wage. So absolutely, I think vocational education has a really, really key role to play in that.
And as Nicola has pointed, obviously you raised in your earlier remarks as well, the need to ensure that there's a greater focus on vocational education, need to ensure actually that it is actually particularly valued within our society, because that's also a degree of culture change, sometimes even as well among the aspirations of parents in that regard.
I think the most important word there, Peter, is aspirations. And I think that whenever, I'll reinforce, whenever young people are defined by their GCSE level, that's regrettable. As a parent myself, living in a Protestant working class area such as Greater Shankill and bringing up two teenage boys, I understand that each one of them is different. Just because they're brothers and siblings doesn't mean that they go down the same pathway in life, and that I will encourage them to be the best that they can be in their chosen route. And one of them is going down the vocational route in motor mechanics, and I will support him and encourage him as much as possible. The other will go down the academic route, and he will equally be supported. And I think as society, that's what we need to do, is value our young people, not value what they achieve in terms of GCSE grades.
We turn, as time is marching on, to one final subject, which is recently, obviously, the Assembly has gone through the second stage reading of its shared education legislation. And I suppose, in part, there are two interactive aspects to that. One is, I suppose, on the broader cross-community element of things. The second is on actually trying to build links between schools on different socioeconomic backgrounds, which is vital, I think, to try to ensure that there's that learning experience, because shared education can be both, has a societal benefit, an educational benefit, and I think also from the point of view of an efficiency side of it. I suppose, first of all, Emma, if I turn to yourself, in terms of what you see as sort of the hopes for shared education, particularly as we move forward, and obviously, for instance, the provision both for shared education and shared housing is a key level of financial support that's been put into the Fresh Start Agreement. And maybe if you can give us some views on how you see that moving forward.
Well, I think there are many elements, as you pointed out, in relation to shared education. And I do think that the umbrella term is used to respect certain issues such as parental choice, but it also recognises that there is a big benefit, it's an evidence-based benefit in terms of mixing. You've highlighted the issue around social and economic groups mixing. You know, what we've found in many of the youth programmes that we've examined is that where young people, perhaps from poorer backgrounds with lower aspirations, do mix in a group with those young people from better off backgrounds and maybe more privileged backgrounds, that raises the aspiration right across the group. And one of the critical issues for our young people who at the moment are underachieving is very much to look at raising those aspirations, letting a child understand that they can achieve, that there is support there for them. They can be what they want to be. So there are proven evidence-based positive outcomes for this type of work. So, you know, I think it's a welcome agenda. I think there's huge potential with it. It's still at an early stage, and I think there's a lot of consultation yet to happen about what that actually means in substance. But those conversations have already started, and we're looking forward as a party to talk to a range of people as well about what that will mean in the rollout.
And I'll maybe turn finally to Andrea, because one of the times the myths in relation to sharing of education is that people see in Northern Ireland, particularly looking from outside, a very sort of, it seems to be a very segregated system. And indeed, there's almost a myth that on the ground that there isn't already good work going on in terms of sharing between schools and between sectors. What's been your experience in Ocker of that level of relationship, particularly with the maintained sector?
Yes, well, I think all shared education for it to work really needs to start with the staff. If you have staff who'll buy in and engage, you're on to a winning start straight away. And certainly in the Clocker Valley, we have recently set up a 7-cluster school where we will work together for professional development amongst our staff. Now, if I get my children together with the local maintained sectors, we can spend all day discussing John Deere's, Massey Ferguson's, whose dad's doing the silage. We have no problem interacting and chatting. The language skill is fantastic, and the learning opportunities are there. You know, there's great interaction going on the ground. Ocker isn't the easiest community. There's been a hard and a long pass there. As a school, we're very forward-thinking. We do want to develop our shared education. The workload demanded for shared education is the biggest drawback for some of my colleagues, because it is another huge amount of workload being heaped on a very busy plate. But, you know, if there's money available, if it's going to be advantageous for the children in our care, if it's going to provide for a better curriculum, there will always be buy-in from schools on the ground. And there is brilliant stuff. We go swimming together, we have coaching, we go to trips. We had a brilliant programme last year with the PSNI. So there's wonderful things going on. If you look into shared education, Londonderry have some brilliant science things going on at the minute. Dromore and County Tyrone have fabulous ICT projects going on between 5 schools. It's there, it's happening. We just need to encourage it, and we need to make it a wee bit easier for schools to access the facilities and access the money for shared education.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, obviously we could go on for a long, much longer period, but while my family would be very keen to see me on the television at noon, I suspect it may not be something that would necessarily be shared. Can I just say, I suppose, in conclusion, that the DUP have always regarded education as being a critical issue. I suppose one of the advantages that I have had as coming in as chair of the Education Committee is being able to build on the good work and try and fill the very large shoes of Sammy Wilson, Mervyn Storey and Michelle McElveen. And I would just like to take this opportunity to pay tribute to my predecessors. This will be an issue, indeed the range of issues, and we could have touched on a lot more today, that as a party we regard as being very central to Northern Ireland moving forward, and that we will be keeping a very close eye on and trying to ensure that the right results are got for the next generation, indeed generations to come. So in conclusion, I'd just like to thank our panel, Andrea, Emma, Nicola and Liz, and if you could maybe show your appreciation to the panel.